Okay, so somebody asked Scott whether they should have a look at the Linux serial driver. Yes and no, and the no part I think will become more apparent today. Yes, in the sense that the Linux serial driver is probably a pretty good way to get a handle on what the programming interface looks like for the UART chip. There's a process of initializing that chip and setting it up and setting it up for a particular baud rate. And so there's an initialization sequence that amounts to touching the right registers with the right values in the right order. Just about any serial driver does that in the same way, and the Linux driver is just as good or bad an example as any other. And similarly, there is a there's a protocol, more or less, for talking to the chip to get serial data. There's at least on the recent versions of the chip, there's a FIFO, there's a register you talk to that says, I want to fetch things out of the FIFO, and then there's a series of operations that you do to actually do the fetching from the FIFO. And the read routine and the write routine down in the Linux serial driver are a perfectly fine way to learn how to do that. So in terms of learning what the chip interface looks like, it's a fine way to go. In terms of learning how to build a serial driver, I'm for Kyotos, I'm a little more skeptical. And the reason is that the Linux bottom half, top half structure doesn't really apply the same way in Kyotos. And the means of dealing with streams is also a bit different. And I want to try to talk about both of those issues today. See if I can explain what the problem is. The purpose of the bottom half of a driver in Linux is to do that part of the interrupt processing that really can't be deferred until after the interrupt, because you'd like to do as little as possible in the interrupt handler. Some of that is because of the problems with global variables and concurrency management. Some of that is just because while you're in an interrupt handler, you're mostly not doing anything else, and so the longer your interrupt handlers run, the more impact they have on scheduling and priority mismanagement. That mostly doesn't apply in Kyotos because the drivers in Kyotos are normal applications running under the normal scheduling regime. So interrupts do not live at a de facto higher priority than other tasks in the system. It's good and bad. I mean, it's good because it means the interrupt handlers don't get in the way of things that might be more important. It's bad because it means you have to plan your scheduling better. But one result of that is that the bottom half, top half distinction still exists, but it exists for a different reason. It does not exist because of the constraints on interrupt behavior. And there are things that you might choose to do in a bottom half if you were not constrained by the presence of the interrupt mechanism. And there are interactions between the top half and the bottom half that have to do with the way concurrency works in the Linux interrupt regime. I could have an application that's doing a write or doing a read that is executing in the top half at the time that the interrupt comes in, which is going to cause the bottom half to run. And that interrupt effectively preempts the top half, and the bottom half runs as a result. And now this is exactly the case that we were worried about with these global variables, which is you actually now have somebody in the top half who's accessing these variables that are exactly the ones that we have to handle with some care in order to get the bottom half stuff to work on. What the heck is going on here? Isn't that helpful? No idea that SmartD was so stupid. That's exactly the scenario that you're kind of worried about. In the Kyotos case, the picture is a little bit different. And finally, for historical reasons, the Linux serial driver uses a particular data structure for managing incoming and outgoing data that turns out not to be a very good data structure. And so it's not one that's sort of a good model to replicate. In the Kyotos story, the picture is a little bit different because you're not constrained by the interrupt issue. And with a little bit of care, you don't have to be constrained by the concurrency issue. What we typically see in a Kyotos driver is that you have some hardware device at the bottom, like the serial device. And you want to think of it as having two flows. And I don't like to use read and write here, because who's reading and who's writing is a matter of your point of view. So I prefer to think of them as the upflow and the downflow. The downflow is the one that's leading out of the machine, and the upflow is the one that's coming from the hardware up into the software system. And so in typical usage, if I'm looking at it from the application perspective, when I do a write to the serial chip, right, the data is going to proceed on the downflow towards the serial chip and then to the, presumably to the wire that's connected. And to a read, I'm reading data that has been preceding the upflow. And what we'll often see is that this down and up pattern is actually replicated across a series of bits of application code. So typically, sitting above the serial module, you'll have a line discipline module. This is the thing that does erase backspace processing, kill the beginning of line. In some systems, it may even do line editing. Well, this thing also has a downflow and an upflow, right? And then somewhere up here, there's an application. If we're talking about a serial port that's sitting, what? Not supported. Oh, how lovely. Okay, that doesn't seem good. That may turn out to be the right answer, but no signal. Okay, that's not promising. Let's see. All right. There's another trick worth trying.
All right. While that's rebooting.
So you see this pattern going again and again. Now, typically what will happen at the application level is there's really only one thread of control, and that's doing a read or a write call. That read or write call will tend to be blocking. You don't typically read at the same time that you write. If this was a modem program, a terminal program, it actually might be doing that, but in general, you probably don't.
I'm a little concerned about this because I mean, good, okay. Let me try to restart the machine without the
switch. Sometimes it gets good. Shelly, Matt, yeah, Scott, probably we should grab the. Why don't you go grab it just in case we need it? Where we'll put it is the problem. I love Hopkins equipment. Okay, so normally this would be a very simple mechanism. At the hardware level, what's going on is interrupts. So somewhere you have some thread of control that enters the kernel and does a wait. I'd say it does a wait for interrupt, but that's not quite the right way to think about it. There's a kind of a capability that it holds, which is IRQ, I think it's IRQ wait capability. And there's an operation. So an IRQ wait capability is a capability that gives you authority to wait for a particular interrupt line. Wait operation is the means of doing that. So the application operates by calling the wait operation, and conceptually inside the kernel, it goes on a queue until the interrupt is actually present. The interrupt actually occurs if it hasn't already. If it has already occurred, we simply mark the fact that it's been delivered, the application returns immediately. If the interrupt has not already occurred, if you go down and you look at the wait operation in IRQ wait, what you'll find is that the behavior is, well, enable the interrupt at the hardware level so that we can notice it when it occurs, and go to sleep on the queue. Actually, I need to be careful. Go to sleep on the queue first, then enable the interrupt. Why? I'll come back to that in a second. It turns out there's an order of operation issue here. And then later, when the interrupt actually occurs, what will happen is we will mark the fact that it occurred. Having done that, we will mask the interrupt, because until we want the next one, we're not really interested in that interrupt anymore, and we will need to wake up everybody on that queue. Same news there. So the story is, mark the interrupt pending, mask the interrupt, pre-interrupt has an associated vector, so we're going to wake up everybody on that vector's stall queue. So given that this is the wake-up sequence, why does it matter whether I unmask first or put myself on the stall queue first? What could happen if I unmask first? I could get the interrupt immediately before I've gone on the stall queue. And if I'm not there to be woken up, guess what? I won't get woken up. So this is one of these cases, it's one of the rare cases in the Kyoto's kernel where you go to the stall queue about control, because there's this one other step, which is the unmask step, that has to happen before the stall queue can, before you can yield the processor. You actually have to get on the stall queue and then unmask the interrupt. Okay. So, but later the interrupt occurs, and what actually happens, you're on a stall queue, so what's really happened, we've cheated. And in theory, your system call has made no progress. So Kayetta's system calls are atomic, so the mere fact that you're on a stall queue tells us that you haven't made any progress in your system call. That's a little funny, okay, because progress is measured in a rather oddball way here. What's really going on here is you checked the state of a state machine, and because the state machine told you, and that's not going to be far enough away,
I know,
because the state machine told you that the interrupt was not pending, you went to sleep on this stall queue. And what's going to happen when you get woken up, it's not that you're going to notice the interrupt, it's that you're going to re-execute the system call from scratch. But this time, when the time comes to check the stall queue, you're going to see the interrupt is pending, and that's the condition that allows the system call to complete. This is a very peculiar, dodgy sort of abuse of the atomic system call rule. The point of this is, there is some application somewhere that's saying, wait for the next interrupt. Okay? And it is in a blocking wait for that interrupt. So the catch here is, if it's in a blocking wait for that interrupt, it cannot simultaneously be serving requests on behalf of the driver. So in some sense, this thread that's waiting for interrupt corresponds to the bottom half of the Linux driver. It's a process. The calls wait for interrupt, this is similar to the way the bottom half says, call my procedure when the interrupt occurs. What's going to happen is when the interrupt comes in, it's going to go and call that procedure, whatever it may be. And it's just going to sit in a loop doing it. Some of the interrupts that come in are going to be related to the object.
To move this before we do vibrations into the recording.
Sorry.
Some of those interrupts are going to be related to the up channel. They're going to reflect data that's coming in. Some of those interrupts, I wasn't actually done experimenting with the overhead projector either. I've actually been waiting for my laptop to show something on the display. I will bring in the laptop from my other office, and we'll show this. Or I'll arrange to come in some other time this week. Actually, if I want to come in some other time this week and show this, what's a good time to do it? Because I don't see it.
They might have fixed it.
They might have what? Fixed it?
They might have fixed it. There is one there.
So it's got this weird thing tucked into this channel strip, right? But the channel strip doesn't go anyplace useful. And then it's got this little stubby thing, right? That's not long enough to be useful to anybody.
You could just, there's a wall jack over there. If you had a long enough cable, just unplug one of
them. Yeah, it's not clear that we have a long enough cable.
What's that?
Or
there may be one hanging in the rack in the closet. Let's see what we can do. Okay, all right, well, let me stay on this because Scott can hunt that down. So, some of those interrupts are going to be relating to data coming in. Right, and some of those interrupts relate to data going out. The ones going out are saying, okay, you put some data in the outbound FIFO, and the outbound FIFO is now, once again, empty enough that you could put more data into it. That's usually the way you set these things up. So the interrupts related to the down channel say, I am prepared to accept more data. Putting data into the FIFO, as long as you don't hit the end of its capacity, does not involve any delay. You write the data, and it's accepted immediately for delivery. Upbound interrupt says there are characters available to be read from the upbound FIFO, and those have to be read because the FIFO will overrun if you don't read them pretty quickly. So when you say wait for an interrupt and you get one, the next step is to thump the chip to find out what the interrupt was. And what happens is there's a status register of the chip that tells you what is the status of the various functional elements of the chip. So there's a bit that says there is data in the input FIFO. There's a bit that says the output FIFO is not yet full. Another bit that says the output FIFO is empty. It's been a long time since I've looked at the UART. And the driver is actually expected to know enough about the function of the chip that given these bits and given its knowledge of what it has put in and its knowledge of what the capacity of the chip is, that the driver is able to figure out, hey, I know I've put three characters in the FIFO and the FIFO holds four. So I know what's there. I know how much more will go in. This is very low-level programming, and the chip interface doesn't give you very much help. But if I have a process that's performing a wait for interrupt, and it is in a closed wait, waiting for that call return, then that process cannot simultaneously be waiting for a read request. A read request is going to happen as an inter-process communication from some client, right? Some client has opened up the device and it's now doing a read. And the driver is the one who actually implements the read by talking to the chip. Unfortunately, that read cannot be accomplished by this thread of control. What has to happen is there has to be a second thread of control. And so what we end up with is an address space that is the program image that the UART driver is executing. A process which is basically the one that does the IRQ wait, and at least in the simplest form, a second process that sits at the top doing what amounts to a wait for request. So that one says, okay, wait until my next request, accept it, do something about it, which typically means if it's a write request, take the characters that came in and put them in the write FIFO. There is some modest amount of shared memory between these threads because the write processing can't overflow the FIFO. When the FIFO becomes full, it has to wait. It has to wait until the FIFO becomes empty. Well, how's it going to find, or at least until it has more space? How's it going to find out if it has more space? The chip is going to interrupt it. So the chip interrupt is going to be noticed by this bottom thread of control that's waiting for the chip interrupt. And when it sees that interrupt has happened, it's going to thump the chip and say, okay, why did this interrupt happen? Now it knows the interrupt happened because the write FIFO has drained. At that point, what it has to do is release this thread to continue execution because we're now able to make more progress on the writing. So you can see that there's a concurrency requirement here. And then these two threads have to be aware of each other and have to operate in a protocol that allows them to cooperate. That's what makes building a serial driver in this style of system more than a little bit tricky. Turns out, there's a second problem, and I actually talked about this several weeks ago. If writes are locked, it should not stop reads from making progress. So what's going to happen is somebody is going to come along and do a write request, and that write request is going to block, and somebody else is going to come along and do a read request, and if we have only one thread of control that's processing requests, read request is going to block, not because it has to block, but because the write request is not completed. And if the write request is not completed, that means that this loop has not made it back to wait for request. The pattern here is this thing is going to sit in a loop that says wait for request, decode the request, process the request, now go back and wait for another request. And it can't go back and wait for another request until the process request part is completed. I think we might have it.
Well, before I plug you into a port, I'm not quite sure what does. This is the one that's not plugged in over there.
Fine. The worst we'll do is fry the laptop, and the residual value of the laptop at this point is about $10. So
okay.
I'm not that excited yet. You've seen the advertisement, that's right.
Yeah.
Which I get messed up by putting in cuts and doing the reverse. Let's see what happens. This is the at the very least, we'll get some humor about it. I bought this laptop. This thing was fast. Now it's like, oh, bro.
That's the laptop.
Whatever's the laptop.
The laptop. The laptop.
I'm pretty sure it's the laptop. The speed at which this is making progress is actually extremely promising.
Probably good enough, Scott. Okay, he's one alive, fine.
So, what I would suggest for a first cut is ignore the fact that reads and writes are going to interfere, because getting the interactions correct between two threads is already hard enough. And then once you feel like you have a handle on that, then deal with the reader-writer contention issue. And so here's the pattern that will tend to emerge. What we're going to want to have is two different threads, one waiting for reads and the other waiting for writes. And the reason we're going to want that is because we want callers to block differently according to which operation they're doing. The easiest way to do that is to say, if what we're trying to implement is a, quote, file descriptor, unquote, for a serial device, then the way we should go about simulating that is not through a single capability, but through multiple capabilities. And so what we'll do is we will implement a reader capability and a writer capability. Each of these capabilities will name its own endpoint, and the writer capability will point to the process that handles write requests, and the reader capability will point to another process that also sits in a read request loop. I think I have a nasty feeling that the problem may be the disk drive. Yeah. At least, well, I got this far before, very slowly. What's going to happen is when you initially open the serial port, you'll get handed back this pair of capabilities, one that implements the read half of the protocol and the other that implements the write half of the protocol. If we really want to dig into this, we will eventually conclude that we will need a third interface for control operations. For example, we want to be able to issue a reset precisely because a write may not have finished making progress. There are basically two ways you can approach the design problem. One is, you can add more processes so that you can use the queuing behavior of calls on processes to implement the blocking by using the sort of built-in mechanism. Because the second caller will block until the receiver executes its next wait for request. That's one fine design. The downside to that design is, it requires the caller to hold multiple capabilities. Another feasible design is to say, well, I prefer not to do that, so what I'll do is I will design my system such a way that I'm always prepared to hold on to the maximum size write, and I will make as much progress as I can with the request that I'm given. If I cannot make all the progress that was asked for, the way I will handle that is I will reply with a status indicating that partial progress occurred. The caller should make this other call to voluntarily go to sleep, and I will tell it that more progress can be made. The problem that originally pushed us into the multiple process design was the fact that the communication underpinning was synchronous, blocked, and that non-completed write caused reads to be blocked. The other way to design the protocol is to say, well, I'll simply design it so that a write never fails to complete. It may complete with only partial effect, but it always completes. And I'll design a cooperative protocol, and the way the design of the cooperative protocol is, I'm going to make a bet. The bet goes, I'm going to bet that most callers are not stupid. They're not going to hand me more data than I can handle, or if they're forced to hand me more data than I can handle, they want the data to get to the wire, so they have an incentive to cooperate in the protocol. And one way they might cooperate is by letting me say, okay, you asked me to put 20 bytes in the wire, I have put 3 on the wire. Here's a different capability. Go call this capability. That will cause you to block. I'm telling you, I've made 3 characters worth of progress. And I will wake up anybody sleeping on that other capability, then I am prepared to make more progress. If you want the remaining 17 characters to go, you better go sleep over there. Now, why is that protocol, from the implementer's perspective, from the receiver's perspective, why is that protocol a little simpler? The problem is that the read operation and the write operation, if they were completely isolated from each other, then there wouldn't be any crosstalk between these channels, and we'd have no problem to worry about, and either design would be equally easy to do. Fortunately, there's this thing called flow control. Flow control means that not only are there concurrency interactions between the interrupt layer and the request layer, but there are concurrency interactions between one request and the next request. In particular, if I'm doing software flow control, a control S that's coming in the up channel alters the behavior of the down channel. I'm pretty convinced that what happened here is that I put up the sentry, so let me take it out. Why is that difficult? Well, it's not because there's interaction between the channels. I mean, that's one source of the difficulty. But the other source of the difficulty is that you don't know when these interactions are going to occur because they're happening in different processes. And because they're happening in different processes, it's not just serial concurrency, it's actual concurrency. Because the scheduler could dispatch these processes with any schedule at all. And so you literally can have the situation that the write thread performs one instruction and then the read thread gets control, and it could turn out that that instruction is like just the least convenient one for your purposes. If you can get the victim to voluntarily back off, what you can do is you can force all of that traffic into a single thread of control. If you force all that traffic into a single thread of control, then you know that you can't have a read and a write operating at the same time. And if they can't, because you forced them to operate sequentially. And if they can't be operating at the same time, you still have to check status flags, but you don't have to worry about whether you and I could be updating the status flag while you're reading. So the cooperative protocol lets you do that. And it doesn't entirely eliminate the problem. I'm gonna think that this isn't helping.
Well, it's not helping because I can't read. Right. If that helps or hinders.
Yeah, you are still going to have a concurrency interaction because what's going to happen is you're going to get a request you can't process, and you're going to go back to the caller and say, I will process this later. Go make an I'm going to sleep request over there. Now, the I'm going to sleep request is a little tricky because that does need another thread. Well, because suppose you're in a situation where you want to block write requests but not read requests. So anybody who comes in with a write request, you're going to respond, not ready, go sleep over there. Anybody who comes in with a read request, you're going to go ahead and do some amount of processing. Well, if that's the case, you can get into a situation where when you tell the write request, go sleep over there, somebody has to be listening for the I want to go to sleep request. And the easiest way to implement the I want to go to sleep request is to have a thread that's doing a wait for request. It simply blocks the second requester naturally and returns when the first wait is done. This is not making a lot of sense.
Let me just think a second about how to approach this differently. I had to display out this would be a lot easier. I was really relying on that today. I'm not convinced this thing is on the CS net, Scott. Oh, that's much more promising. Oh, good. Oh, fantastic. This will help a lot. Well, I mean, it's crazy, right? I went to a fair bit of effort to get the laptop to the point where it might conceivably use a
record.
And of course, I'm getting all this help from the infrastructure.
Right. The receiver in this story is sitting in a loop. And the loop approximately looks like this. As long as I receive a new message, message includes an opcode that says what request I'm receiving. Dispatch on the opcode, do something about it, send a reply, and then wait for the next request. That's the usual server pattern. There are other server patterns, that's the common. I'm oversimplifying it a little bit, because the interface is not receive message and send reply. The interface is a single operation that says send reply and receive the next message, because you only want to do this with a single, you want to do this with a single system call if you can pull it off.
Awful. I'm just going to count this a total failure. Wasting our time. What happens internal to the do something part is you're either talking to a piece of hardware or you're making some other call that can block or something of this nature. And so until you're done
doing something, you're not waiting for the next request to come in. What happens is anybody else who calls you gets blocked until you wait for the next request. Or perhaps they say, I'm not willing to block, in which case their message doesn't go through and they move on, but you know, it's not your problem. And what happens if the request that comes in is a write request and do something is putting characters into the FIFO on the UART and the FIFO fills up? You basically have two choices. You can wait for the UART to get empty, or you can essentially in return early saying, you asked me to write 20 characters, and 3 got out. Have the other 17 written, ask again.
Yeah.
On chip, there are separate read and write FIFOs. But on the very earliest ones, didn't have FIFOs at all. They only had a register, but all the other ones had FIFOs. I think anybody shipped one of those in 10 years. Okay, so you can see that if you got stuck processing a write, it's not just that you're unable to process further writes, you're unable to process further reads, unless you somehow get unstuck. There are two ways to get unstuck in this design. One is to say, well, what I'll do is, it's okay for a write to get stuck behind a write. I actually want writes to go out as single units, or at least not to get scrambled. If I do 3 characters from your write, and 3 characters from her write, and 3 characters from his write, then I go back and do 5 more characters from your write, I don't know what the answer is going to look like on the serial wire, and neither do you. That was not a very useful logic. We do see cases where you have multiple applications running the terminal at the same time. Every time you start a background process in Unix, right, you get another process writing the standard out. That standard out is ultimately wired to the same terminal as your shell and whatever process you're running in the foreground. You didn't redirect its output. We really do see situations where multiple processes are doing writes at the same time. And if those processes are sufficiently badly behaved, we will actually see their I.O. intermediate. The reason that the standard I.O. library flushes the output when it sees a new line is in two parts. One is, well, it assumes the program may be interactive and you want to see the results. But then the question is, well, why not flush on every character? Ignoring performance, it turns out there's a good answer for that. The answer is, the choice to flush at every new line has the effect that all but the most obscenely long lines will happen as a single write call. As long as that single write call is atomic with respect to other write calls, a line from process A followed by a line from process B. But you won't see half a line from process A followed by half a line from process B. There is a case where you'll see that. The case where you'll see that is some shell or some application issues a prompt without a new line, explicitly flushes the channel so that you see the prompt, and then some other program writes a line. You may have actually seen that behavior. So if we're trying to allow reads to pass writes or writes to pass reads in the protocol processing, there's basically two ways we can go. We can handle them with different processing loops. That's the story that says I'll have one capability for reads and a different capability for writes. I will serve them with two different processes, each of which is running a wait for request loop. One of them handles read requests, the other one handles write requests. Maybe I'll have to add a third for control requests. That's one possible solution. Possible solution is to say, well, I will redesign the protocol so that the caller must be prepared to call back. And if I can only make partial progress, I will make partial progress. I'll tell you how much I made. I'll say, go over there, and I'll wake you up when I'm ready for more. Then what will happen is, I will end up with the following, is that picture a little bit clearer? The problem basically is a queuing problem, and what we're really doing is figuring out whether we're going to use a cooperative strategy for queuing or a multiprocessing strategy for queuing. In the multiprocessing strategy, the queues that we're using are built into the messaging subsystem. The cooperative strategy is going to turn out they are also built into the messaging subsystem, but we're going to use them in a different way. Now, what would prompt me to one design or the other? Concurrency management is actually tricky in the multi-thread design, that is in the one thread per channel design. That tends to argue for the cooperative strategy. The problem with the cooperative strategy is that at some point you're going to need a translator, because sooner or later somebody's going to want a Unix process, and you're then going to need essentially an adapter that knows how to do the Unix style I.O. behavior and translate it into the cooperative behavior, because this isn't the way Unix tends to work. Okay? That's not actually all that hard. The other disadvantage to the one thread per channel strategy is that the client is forced to hold multiple capabilities, one for read, one for write, one for control, so the single file descriptor now turns into 3 descriptors. In cooperative strategy, what's typically going to happen is I'll have one capability, I'll make the operation. If I need to go block someplace else, the capability that I should block on will get returned to me as part of the reply message. So there is a window of time when I need to hold a second capability, but that window of time is ephemeral. It's not a long-term hold. It's local to the procedure that implements the client side of the write protocol. That's probably the preferred design. All right, so let's push that design. Ha, I have a blank space in the middle. Ah, it's good to know that the retractor springs are of no higher quality than the display mechanism of the network. So, how the story is, I'm going to do this with two threads of control. Actually, the relationship between them just became much simpler. It turns out, the thread waiting for the IRQ, if I'm using this kind of voluntary pushback mechanism, can also use the same dispatcher. How does this work? Well, here's an endpoint that names the serial process, right? When I say names the serial process, what I really mean is it kind of names a thread of control that's executing one of these receive message loops. Here's an entry capability that points to that endpoint. And here's a caller. If I'm able to fully process the request, this is all I need to see. Room in the FIFO, you do a write, I take all the characters, and all I'm going to have to do is say, good, I'm done. It worked. Okay. Well, what about the interrupts? How do I know when an interrupt has occurred? At the very least, if you do a read request, I may need to block you until there are characters present. Again, if they're present in the FIFO, I'm good. But sooner or later, you're going to do a read for characters I don't have. So let's look at what that looks like. Her request comes in through this entry capability, through the endpoint, gets to my process, and I see it's a read request, and I do not have enough characters to fulfill it. What I need to do is basically say, look, I'll return to you later, and I need to get you to get out of the way because I need to be able to take in a write request or a control request. I need to reply somehow. I need to reply in a way that says, we're not done, you need to cooperate with me to do more protocol. What I'm probably going to do is I'm going to set up a second endpoint. This endpoint points to my process as well. One of the things that I can do when I am receiving, I can say, I only want to receive from a particular endpoint. The way I'm going to differentiate these endpoints is I'm going to assign them different endpoint IDs. I will write the IDs in the upper corner. So this is going to be endpoint 1, and this is going to be endpoint 2. Endpoint 0, by convention, is reserved for replies. In normal operating mode, this process does not do an open wait. It does, under normal operating mode, a closed wait, waiting for requests appearing on endpoint 1. Endpoint 2 is out there, but it is not normally listening on endpoint 2. So the read comes in, I cannot service it. What I basically need is for the caller to go to sleep in such a way that I can wake them up later. The way I'm going to do that is I'm going to send them back a capability to endpoint 2. I'm going to say, repeat the request over there. Now, he executes his request on endpoint 2, where I am not listening. It has the effect of causing him to block because I am not listening. So far, so good. Got the reader queue. Flip over to ignore you. It might be, by the way, that they don't re-execute the actual read operation. It might be that the operation they'll execute is wake me up when there's data to be read. I choose to change the protocol this way. Later, yeah.
When they take the capability to endpoint 1.
Oh, they need to hang on to the capability to endpoint 1.
So then other readers are going to block. If other people want to read, they're going to wait for endpoint 1. No.
Once we're blocking requesters, every requester who comes in is going to get told, go try again over there. We want them all to enqueue on endpoint 2. So each one comes in, we're going to say, nope, go call over there. By the way, this is a piece of protocol that Capital can't express. It doesn't make sense, I'll come back to it. Now later, it's available to UR. Interrupt goes off. And at that point, this process, which has been waiting for that interrupt, gets woken up. The mere fact that it has woken up tells us that an interrupt has occurred. In this design, what it does is it also holds a capability to endpoint 1. And what it does is a post-interrupt request. This is a request, right? This is really an advisory request. An interrupt has occurred. What that does is it causes us to go into the receive message loop, doing the case of interrupt has occurred, I'm going to look at the chip to see what the interrupt means, and the interrupt might mean there's data to be read. I got to come back to this because there's a bit of fine print here that's a potential problem. Boom, the interrupt means there's data to be read. We found this out by going and talking to the chip. So if there's data to be read, then we would like to wake up a reader. And the simplest way to wake up a reader is to accept the request off of endpoint 2. So what we're now going to do is we're going to run the main processing loop, but instead of waiting on endpoint 1 in the main processing loop, we're going to accept a requester off of endpoint 2. We're just going to change which endpoint we listen to during this operation. Now, this is a little problematic because there's a hazard. We'll come back to dealing with the hazard. The hazard is there might be nobody on endpoint 2 and we don't want to block forever waiting there. The hazard here is we don't want just anybody to be able to issue an interrupt posting request. That would allow an arbitrary client to come along and say, oh, an interrupt occurred on the UART. Not something we want an arbitrary client to be able to do. So when I say that the IRQ wait capability holds a capability to endpoint 1, this is not quite right. What it really holds is, I forget whether we're calling it app notify or app notice this week. This allows it to post a notification event to main thread. Notification event is simply a bit. It's a bit that goes into a word in the process state, and the next time the process receives, for any reason at all, on any endpoint, will get the notification in preference to an actual message. From the receiver's perspective, the notification looks like a message that came in from a well-known endpoint. So I may be waiting on endpoint 2, but I'll get this notice. First thing, we have a protocol problem. That's how I know the interrupt happened, and that's how I know to go check if the interrupt occurred. What the interrupt means. And the story that I've given you is not going to work, and I've got to go back and look at this. But let's pretend it's going to work. So the hazard was there might be nobody requesting on endpoint 2. Basically, what I want to do is I want to get the request if there's one to be got. Now, I do not want to block if there's nobody sleeping there. But what I'm going to do is I'm going to do a non-blocking receive on endpoint 2. There's a request out there that'll cause me to get it. Now I'll go ahead and process the read request with the data that I have in hand. I have to preserve the separation between readers and writers because I want those two things to be able to bypass each other. I'm going to do that with a third endpoint. And so if you come in the read request, I'm going to ask you to go to sleep on endpoint 2. That's my endpoint of pending readers. And with the write request, I'm going to ask you to go to sleep on endpoint 3. That's my endpoint of pending writers. I'm simply going to arrange to only listen to those endpoints when I'm ready to process those kinds of requests. What's happening here is I'm exploiting a cooperative protocol and the inherent blocking properties of the underlying communication mechanism to get my callers to end up on the appropriate queues. Now, I said this wasn't quite going to work. The reason this won't quite work as described is the notices are not delivered if I'm in a closed wait. So, the story that I was going to sit in a closed wait normally on endpoint 1 and just not accept requests from endpoint 2 and endpoint 3 doesn't quite work. This is an architectural issue in the IPC mechanism that we have for a good way out of this in the current system. I'm going to be doing a long discussion with Jonathan Adams tomorrow morning. There are several possible ways to deal with this. One is to add a bit to the endpoint that basically allows us to block and unblock them explicitly. That would work. The second would be, it's a variant of the same story, a couple of things along those lines. The second obvious one would be to add a bit that says, I'm willing to accept a notification as a response to this way. These would work. But what we had failed to consider was that there would be reasons to do closed waits in receive in order to demultiplex concurrency issues. We failed to consider it entirely. And this is all over, however, and assuming we've resolved this issue. What we're going to end up with is a situation where a single processing loop operating in a single thread of control is going to be able to do the job, right? It's going to have a little state machine that says which endpoint it should attempt to receive on. Depending on how that state machine is set up, it'll read off at the appropriate endpoint. Okay, so far what the story does is it lets me enqueue readers and writers, and lets me block them until I have data for the readers or until I'm prepared to accept data for the writer. You believe that much. Let's look, so this gets me readers versus writers. It's one source of interaction. Let's look at writers versus writers. Same issue for readers versus readers. Pick one. First writer comes along and says, I have 20 bytes to write. And the second writer comes along and says, well, good, I have 40 bytes to write. Hippo will take 4 bytes. 16 bytes if you have a really fancy serial chip. Something like this. Needless to say, these writes are not going to fit. And at 20 bytes, you might say, well, ignoring flow control, the delay might not be very long, I'll just wait. With flow control, right, if I write 3 of those 20 bytes and I get hit with hardware flow control, I'm not going to make any further progress until the person at the other end of the terminal line who just went for coffee returns. I'm not going to be able to process any reads. Possible design options. That is to say, I will, as a matter of specification, state that there is an upper bound on the number of bytes you can supply in a write. In fact, we have to do that anyway because the IDL protocol requires us to state such a bound. And we'll design into the serial controller enough buffering space that we know that it can fully buffer the largest possible write. This might induce us to choose a modest size of buffer. And the reason for doing this would be that it will allow us to avoid ever getting into a situation where we've only processed part of a write request. Right? Internally, what will happen is the write request will immediately go into a buffer, and then we'll make some progress on that buffer, and we will not attempt to process the next write request until the buffer's empty. So we won't get to a situation where we've done 3 out of 20 characters, and we have to ask that caller to call us back again. The other possible design is don't buffer anything. Make the progress you're able to make, and having made the progress that you're able to make, demand that the caller call you back. But watch what happens if you do that. Suppose you process 3 of those 20 characters. You say, call me back. Well, it's as if the guy called you originally with 3 characters, and later called you again with the remaining 17. Notice that we just violated the no interleave rule. Because what's going to happen is the party with the 40 bytes to be written is going to be sitting on the queue and may well get woken up before that original 20 byte write has completed. How that can happen? Okay, what can you do about it? One thing you can do, add another couple of endpoints. That's not going to work so well. What's going to happen if you add another couple of endpoints is you're going to get into a race. This is going to look like this. I tell you to go to sleep on some endpoint. After I tell you this, but before you can go to sleep, the interrupt comes in. The interrupt says, I can take more write data. I go to the endpoint, I go into a non-blocking receive, assuming that you're asleep, because you're not asleep yet. Now what we have is a missed write. Later, you'll go to that endpoint, you'll go to sleep in the way that you were supposed to, I'll never see you. It's a protocol design problem. Conversely, I don't know that you will ever go to sleep on that endpoint, so I cannot do a blocking wait on that endpoint, because if I do a blocking wait on that endpoint, I could get rudely surprised. It's a problem. Once your request goes away, I do not know if you will ever issue another request. Problem with the cooperative design. And one of the problems in a system like this generically is the drivers have to be defensive. Whenever they engage in a collaborative protocol, the collaborative protocol has to have a well-defined result when the other party does not actually collaborate. Sure, if I ask you to wait over there, and you actually go and wait over there, life's pretty good. They rely on you to do that. The protocol's very simple to design. If I can't rely on you to do that, things become very tricky very quickly. Actually, beginning to suspect here that we really need to have enabled it for this.
Just stick with the buffer way. It doesn't
stick with the buffer.
Yeah,
does that seem better to people? So actually, I think the buffer design is simpler. But the catch with the buffer design is I'm still going to get into a situation where I need to block the second writer. And that's nice because that doesn't require me to do any selectivity on the endpoints. Well, writers versus readers, maybe I have to, but that's sort of a manageable issue. But once I'm done servicing the write, I can basically say, okay, I'll take write requests from anybody. And it doesn't really matter if the request comes in on endpoint 2 or endpoint 1. You know, it comes in when it comes in, and when it comes in, I'll deal with it. Right? So this is sort of the right intuition for how to deal with this. How to deal with reader versus writer blocking. That design won't really solve that problem very gracefully. And I also have to deal with the consequences of buffering. Right? So buffering at the level of the serial trip driver doesn't really look too bad. Buffering network packets is a little more costly. And if I have buffering across multiple layers, I get all sorts of interesting emergent behaviors that may not be the behaviors I wanted. But look, the point I'm trying to get at here is actually a serial driver is not a trivial thing to implement. It looks like it ought to be very simple, read a character, write a character. But when you try to overlay that onto a mechanism that is synchronous and blocking, looking at the protocol design is a non-trivial problem.
I don't know that they're calling you. Just decide I'm going to wait for them for...
That's a problem. Right. The answer is actually there's no way out in that path.
Does IRQ8 ever have a timeout?
No. IRQ8 does not have a timeout. And the rationale is it turns out that from the driver perspective, you basically have to dedicate a thread to waiting for the interrupt anyway. But the reality is you would time it out when you're shutting the driver down. If you're shutting the driver down, you're going to whack the process anyway, so why worry about a timeout? Well, I've identified sort of a hellaciously bad protocol design problem here, right? The thing that I've been pushing for to get implemented is the keyboard driver, which turns out to have exactly the same issues. Right? It has to be able to read a key. It also has to be able to write a little bit of stuff to update the LEDs on the keyboard. You may not have known it, but your keyboard is an output device as well as an input device. It's also an output device because it is a state machine that the driver can control by writing bytes to it. So my thought was that by implementing the structure of the keyboard driver, you know, there would be a different driver that would provide, in effect, a cheat sheet for the protocol design. I'm making good progress. We have the interrupt stuff now in place. And I spent a lot of time over the last week cleaning up the text console that I was going to show you today. Getting to the place where we can demonstrate that. The next step is to do the keyboard driver stuff. Evidently, we have some stuff to think about. Remember how we dealt with this in Eros, because the same issue arose. And I know why it arose. Okay. So the way we dealt with this in the Eros case, there's a similar problem structurally. In the Eros case, we had two mechanisms that don't, well, one mechanism that doesn't exist in Coyotes, and one mechanism that I haven't described. So the mechanism that doesn't exist is in Eros, the pushback operation, the operation that says go wait on the other queue, is not voluntary. If you call me and you're willing to block, I can induce you to re-execute the request on another endpoint. And short of you being destroyed, you will do that. The permission for me to redirect you was implicit in making a blocking request on. The system had an operation called pushback. And what pushback did was it said, okay, go perform the same operation you just did, but rather than perform it on the capability that you invoked originally, here is a substitute capability and you should invoke it on that instead. But the substitute capability was an endpoint that nobody was listening on, or the corresponding object in Eros. This had the effect of causing you to block. The wake-up mechanism was also different. I could go to that, in Eros was called a node, and I could say, wake everybody up who's blocked on this node and cancel their redirection. This had the effect of forcing them to re-execute the original request back on the primary channel. The mechanism was different. I did buffering. Why does that mechanism not exist in Coyotes? I did not pay him for this question. I have a processing chain in which A calls B calls C. In both systems, it is possible to design a protocol in which A calls B, B forwards the request, the effect that C will respond directly to A. By forwarding the request, B drops out. And expected sequence then is that any calls actually replies as the mechanism of forwarding the request. C doesn't know, it sees an incoming request. It doesn't know whether that request was the result of a pull reply or a call. It's bits. Eros, the state machine for whether I'm willing to receive another request, has to do with, is purely a matter of the sender, and it depends on which operation the sender did. So the decision to do a call or a reply, the call says I'm in a closed wait until the response. The reply says I'm in an open wait. So by perverse combinations of messages, you can do this thing where B basically drops out in the middle, and then C, when it does get around to replying, B has forwarded the reply capability to A, and then C just invokes it. So A is totally oblivious to this happening. So C now gets a request that it believes came from A. What we know is there's been some processing in the middle. And what it does is it hijacks this message and it puts it on a queue. But which request did it hijack? Now, scenario is the request from A. Assumption, pushback design, was that the caller is calling you directly. The mechanism is you force them to execute their call again. That's what happens when A executes its call again, when this queue is released. Is A will now execute its call again to B. What happens is that the existence of pushback in the design introduces complexity, the existence of pushback in the system architecture introduces significant complexity in any of these intermediaries like B. In fact, B becomes required to be stateless. It can build temporary state while it handles its request, right? But as far as B can tell, this second call that it gets from A has nothing to do with the first call. There's no obvious relationship between these two. If B is something like a logging agent, that might be okay. But if B is something like part of a serial line discipline, right, it's just seen a write request that it's already seen before. It needs to be able to figure that out. It's got no way to do that. The mechanism is removed. Generally, there are other ways to achieve the same result. They involve using more threads of control. So the problem that we were really trying to solve with pushback was avoiding introducing solutions that required either more threads of control or more capabilities that have to be invoked. And the pushback mechanism turned out not to be a good mechanism for doing it. Part of what we were trying to achieve with endpoints was an alternative way to solve this. And the problem is you can't rely on a cooperative protocol. Turns out, the pushback design didn't work either. So with pushback, you knew that you had gotten a blocking call, and you therefore knew that you could do pushback, and pushback would reliably enqueue someplace else. Problem. Yeah, we get reliably enqueued, but if the enqueued process was subsequently destroyed, it was gone. So the problem is that the mechanism of wake up on this queue basically was go back and do whatever your original request was. Furthermore, there had to be a sync fit in this queue that says, well, when a request is made here, do the enqueuing versus, no, right now we're not trying to enqueue people, so if somebody makes a request here, immediately tell them to go back and just cancel the pushback. Right? Because there's that race that you could be still on your way to the queue when I wake everybody up. If you're not there, you won't get woken up. So the queue actually has to have a state bit that says, if somebody attempts to enqueue here, don't. It's a problem, right? It's an interlock problem. It's a classic concurrency interlock. There are no good solutions. There are only more and less ugly solutions. Well, perhaps there are only more and even more ugly solutions.
Isn't another one such a big deal?
Isn't what you're trying to accomplish? I think the answer probably is no, it's not such a big deal.
It seems like, okay, well, we replaced having two capabilities with like lots of endpoints.
Endpoint design may or may not work.
I don't really understand endpoints that well. Are they a lot less complicated or they?
Well, in this design, you're going to have an endpoint for each channel as well. So we haven't reduced the number of endpoints. What we did do was get rid of a concurrency problem. Yeah. The concurrency problem was, look, if I have a multi-threaded driver and it's handling read requests and write requests simultaneously, and if there's any crosstalk between those paths, it now has to deal with all of the atomicity and mutual exclusion issues that any multi-threaded system has to deal with. It might actually be an easier way out of the box.
Yeah, it seems like this is significantly easier.
Trying to go down both paths, you can see them. There are cases where the concurrency becomes sufficiently complicated that you might say, heck with it, I'm going to do something simpler. But I still want to look at that design, because that what's revealed in the example is that we don't have the design of this quite right yet. And we've seen cases where the concurrency is difficult enough that you probably do want to support this. And so I want to look at how to alter the interface so that we can put this other design. There are a couple of approaches that sort of that potentially suggest themselves. One thing we talked about early on in the IPC design and rejected was, and I'm coming to wonder whether that was a good idea, was the idea that instead of selecting on just one endpoint, I could somehow do a filter. I'd say, well, I'll take requests on one and two, but not on three. That would get us out of the box as well, because then we could use our filtering constraints to hold the state machine on which channels we were willing to accept requests on. We still need buffering to keep the writes and the reads from interleaving, but that's fine. That's actually a simplifying. And then the collaborative protocol actually could work, because if the caller doesn't go to sleep, to hell with it. On that. The reason we got in trouble with the caller going to sleep was this problem of the split write and the need to finish one request before we did the next request. Well, the buffer basically guarantees that we're dealing with requests as a single unit. And the filtering out, because I couldn't come up with, well, for two reasons. One is, the filtering mechanism is kind of primitive. It's not a general filter. Right? You have 2 to the 64 possible endpoint values here. And you obviously can't give a list that big to the kernel and expect to process it in any reasonable amount of time. In fact, you really want this list to be something that can be expressed in, you know, sharply bounded storage. So the most you can probably do is some kind of an and or filter where if the answer is non-zero, you accept. That might be good enough to let you say, I will accept messages from all endpoint IDs whose 2-bit is set. That is enough to deal with this kind of scenario. Felt like a kludge, and until we had a motivating use case, I didn't think it was a good idea to put it in, and this may be the motivating use case. In fact, Mr. Adams and I will spend a bunch of time tomorrow morning cursing ourselves about this. I'll sit down and figure out what the hell to do. But the problem with trying to teach an evolving system is you got to teach something about it, and you discover that it needs to evolve. Remember at the beginning I told you you were going to get the insider's view of this and how this stuff really works? Well, here we are. Sorry. Right? This is kind of like the customer calls you up and says, how do you do this? And you say, oh, that's perfectly easy. You do X, Y, and uh-oh. Right? So, you know, oops is a four-letter word. So, look, whichever mechanism gets used, whether it's the masking mechanism, which we're, I think, going to have to introduce something, some version of, or it's the so why is holding multiple capabilities bad? It basically is more memory on the part of the client. And it might even be the cleanest answer. The part that worries me a lot more than the presence of multiple capabilities is the implication that I need a lot more processes per driver. Each of those capabilities names a different process, and all those processes for a given driver share an addressable memory. That's a storage issue that's maybe a little more serious, because the process table is not infinitely large. And multiplying the number of processes in the system by 4 doesn't seem like a clever idea. Even larger than that, though, are the concurrency issues. So for a serial driver, the concurrency issues are not so bad. They're mostly limited to flow control. They're mostly doing character at a time. And that's really not so bad. But think about what's going on in a TCP/IP stack, where you can have 100 packets on their way through the stack going up and down. You have a highly concurrent design. Oddly enough, an enormous amount of the overhead of a TCP stack can result from dealing with concurrency issues. When you move that stack to user level, something very unfortunate happens. That in the kernel, you had the option to do these mutual exclusion things where you had a very intimate relationship with the CPU, and if you decided to sleep, you could get somebody else scheduled in a hurry. It's about 20 cycles to discover that you can't make any progress, and maybe 100 to dispatch the next party. It's more than that, but it's not very big. But for this reason, a kernel mutex implementation is actually a relatively efficient thing that blocks. An application level mutex is not. Because what happens is, when the application level mutex fails to acquire, it has to return to some mechanism that directly or indirectly can invoke the kernel scheduler to get some other process to run. The application itself doesn't have that authority. So what you discover yourself doing is you build a shared memory mutex in application level, and when the shared memory acquisition fails, you turn around and invoke a very heavyweight kernel mechanism, basically for the purpose of invoking a kernel mutex. So a mutex implemented at an application level is inherently decimal orders of magnitude more expensive in the did not acquire case, maybe three decimal orders. This is the hidden cost of moving drivers to user land. The reason you might get away with it is that in practice, these mutexes are not high contention in the drive. But the story is, well, I'm not going to miss the mutex very often. Then the fact that missing the mutex costs 1,000 times as much might not matter. Right? Really expensive things that you don't do, the answer is who cares? But if, in fact, you do see higher contention as a result of moving something to application layer, right, it's plausible that you might. You've got longer context switch delays. Right? When the interrupt comes in, you have a higher latency to actually dispatch the process before you can do anything about it. You're operating under a different scheduling regime because you're operating now under the normal scheduling regime, not under the interrupt scheduling regime. All these things change the interaction patterns around the mutual exclusion. Now, understanding the impact of that change isn't obvious until you've done it. Nothing about mutual exclusion is obvious until it doesn't matter whether it runs at user level or kernel level. But the cost of getting it wrong at user level is going to be the concern. So in a TCP/IP case, the typical approach in TCP/IP is you actually have a timeout. And the down thread and the up thread run more or less independently, but there are ways in which they can get stuck and they handle each other. And one of the TCP timeouts exists partly to give them a chance to become unconstipated. The technical term. I bet you've never heard this used. Is that kind of question? If I'm looking at this, I'm thinking, for this idiom, we actually really do want some kind of a filtering mechanism. And I'm further thinking that the concurrency issue is the one that we have to. It's not the multiple processes, and it's not even the holding multiple capabilities. It's the problem in the eyes of the driver writer of dealing with the concurrency. And it's one thing if you're taking a Linux driver and building a compatibility cradle around it, because the Linux driver is already prepared to deal with all of that concurrency because it exists in a concurrent kernel. So you could imagine doing a wrapper layer around its locking discipline, allowing it to continue to be concurrent exactly as it is now, but just with a much more expensive concurrency mechanism in the low likelihood case. And there are examples of people who've done cradles like that, and those cradles have been pretty effective at allowing people to port Linux drivers to run in application code. There's three or four of them that have been done now, and you know each one builds on the previous work and learns something new and makes the result a bit faster. In that design, you might go for the multi-process solution. That's fine. In that case, you would do a bottom half and a top half process, and that would be better. In Coyotes, in drivers that are designed for Coyotes, there's another issue that arises. So there is another way you could handle this problem. Right? Open the kimono all the way. So it turns out, in effect, you already have the caller queued because the caller is blocked until you invoke the reply capability. As good as queuing them. They're not going anywhere. Okay. So the story here is now I want to accept another caller, right? Because I cannot make progress on the write. I might make progress on the read, and in order to do that, I should accept the next invoker. What happens if the next invoker is doing a write? I have to stick them on my list of people to get back to later. And there's no intrinsic bound on the size of that list. And for each of those pending writes, I have to hang on to the reply capability. As part of what happens in the Linux kernel, when a process calls the kernel and it ends up down to the serial driver, and the serial driver cannot make progress and puts it on a queue, the pointer storage that expresses being on a queue, that pointer state is part of the process state. The process carries around the storage for those two pointers. That's part of being a process. The driver has to use that storage to enqueue the process. And the storage that is occupied is all attributed to the process, or it's not attributed at all. The problem with this in Coyotes is so that's great. The story is, I can't cheat with these pointers in the same way in Coyotes, and the alternative is, can I allocate a little bit of storage for every guy who's sleeping? Yes. happens when I run out? Really want drivers, in most cases, to be able to operate in totally bounded memory. Don't want to build designs that inherently require storage allocation to resolve this sort of problem. If I were willing to simply keep a list, all this stuff can be done with a single thread of control. I take in a request, I'd say, oh, oops, can't do that. I'd basically pickle the request in progress, I'd push it off to the side, I'd stick it on a list, I'd remember where I put the reply capability, I would go right back to the top of my request loop, and I'd say, great, take that next request. Right? And I'd simply manage the list structure internally. And when the interrupt handler came in and I looked at the chip and just said, you have more write data, I would say, okay, you know, who's the party in front waiting for a write? I'd make a little progress, and then if they were done, I'd take them off the list and I would let them return, keeping all of the other writers queued. If the use scenario is that the driver is operating exclusively on behalf of a single user, it might be a fine design. If the drivers share, now what happens is memory exhaustion can be induced by one requester. It causes failure in a second requester.
Yeah.
Where does that capability get? So the proposal is the caller should supply a capability that effectively provides storage in which to store the caller, or my state about the caller. Good. So I'm going to send you a capability that points to the storage. Where are you going to store it? Can't hear you. This is worth going through. I know you see the trap. Let's help everybody else see the trap. So now we're exhausting storage more slowly, right? We reduced a large constant to a smaller constant. This is progress after a fashion. Okay. Well, all right, what would you do about it?
In
which information?
The information or the state of...
Okay, but that reduces it to the same previously unsolved problem, which is where do I store the reply capability? No, these designs never require me to hold on to more than one reply capability. This design that we're contemplating now, that you're exploring, requires me to hold on to an arbitrary number of reply capabilities. The reason I wanted the per-process queuing, the reason I accepted all of these extra processes, was to push the queuing behavior into the kernel so that I would never have to hold more than one reply capability. What am I going to do with the reply capabilities? I have to store them in something. Right. Good. Let me just finish out the trap, because there is a potential way out that doesn't work, and let's all see that it doesn't work. So the next thing to say is, well, I'll implement a linked list. Okay? And you'll provide me with a little storage that can hold capabilities, and we can even arrange this so that you can't read that storage. That is possible. It's tricky, but we could do it. And I'll store the capability of the next guy in this piece of storage that you provided me. Well, this is not so happy-making, because the next thing that happens is you destroy that storage without telling me. And what I've just done is I've lost a box in the middle of my linked list, which means the rest of it's gone forever. So this is one of these areas where precise accountability for storage, in some scenarios is an objective we care about, becomes a source of systemic complexity.
Don't you hold your own linked list, one that you know you wouldn't delete?
Where do I store it? Tell me how I get the infinite supply of storage that's necessary to handle the infinite number of potential
you
requests.
You artificially bound it at a certain, that just automatically rejects any new...
So the proposal now is, I will be prepared to store up to some number of requests, and probably I would segregate it writes versus reads, because I don't want one to overrun the other, fine. So I'm going to allocate some, I'm going to pre-allocate some amount of storage to hold the requesters, and at some point I'm going to tell the next requester to go to hell. You know, for some value of hell. Those of you from other traditions can substitute. Okay, so what's a good value? How do you test?
I would assume you make it like a defined view driver and start trying numbers until it works well.
You have a promising career in Redmond. You're making an ad hoc argument about how to do this design, and unfortunately that's the way people really do these designs, but ad hoc designs do not pass the altitude test. You see the problem?
Yeah.
So the problem is this will work, what's really going to happen, right? You're going to test, all right, and you're going to get a number, and then you're going to scratch your ass, and you're going to say, I don't think this number is quite big enough, I'll round it up to the next power of 2. Now, the next power of 2, right, this is what I call a brown number in the source. The next power of 2 is just as brown as the number that you rounded up. What you accomplish by rounding it up is you guarantee that the problem would never appear in the lab, it would appear in the field. Okay? What did you just do to the cost of the bug? Now, it will be very clear when you run out. The driver will start saying, to hell with human clients. This is a very clear bug to find. What did you do to the cost of the bug? The cost. Yeah. The cost to fix. What did you do to the cost to fix? And whose numbers you believe you just multiply the cost of this bug by between 10 and 100. The bug in the field requires a mass redistribution to fix. You haven't addressed the underlying architectural problem. In principle, your solution does not admit of a principled number. Right, let me offer another way out of this box, because it's not the case that we need to get to one reply capability, it's the case that we need to get to a fixed K. Another possible plan. This one actually will work. Separate the public interface from the private interface. So publicly, you have three separate processes, read, write, control. And a client has to hold multiple capabilities in this design. And these processes exist mainly for the sake of the fact that they only accept one request at a time, and therefore they necessarily queue the second and subsequent requests. Each of them handles their request by immediately calling a worker process. Worker process is prepared to hold up to three reply caps for uncompleted requests. One write, one read, one control. Well, it turns out, by the way, that almost all control operations that block will turn out to be write-related or read-related. The remainder will not block as a matter of pragmatics. Now, the nice thing about that number three is it's not an arbitrary pound to find. It's a number that emerges from the design choice. So in this scenario, what was the question? So
I was saying you could have multiple, right? The three is principled, one of each type, right? So I think one, three blocks.
So that gives us a way out, because now we actually know that there's a bound on the number of pending replies, and it's induced by the structure. The cost of this structure is, I just put an extra context switch in every one of these paths. Every read is going to go through two of them. How expensive is that context switch? A serious question. How expensive is that context switch? Okay. So there are two numbers to consider. One is the cost of the user kernel entry exit path, and the other is the cost to switch address spaces. Separate costs that are usually conflated when people talk about context switch speeds. So which of these is non-negotiable in this design? That is, there's nothing, once I say I'm doing this design, I've committed myself to one of these costs, but not to the other. Which one have I committed myself to? User kernel entry and exit, right? Because I have to re-enter to invoke the worker thread. What could I do to eliminate the address space switch over here? Have all of these processes execute from the same space. So the cost of an address space switch that doesn't actually change the address space is very cheap. What I've done here is trade the endpoint strategy where I needed filtering, right, for a process strategy where I was allocating a process per channel rather than an endpoint per channel. I turned a passive filtering, mostly passive filtering mechanism, into an active filtering mechanism. First was I pushed complexity into the process table. Pressure on the process structure of the table. That's one of the most constrained structures in the system because it's a hard one to page out.
What number of cycles do you generally run that for kernel exit and?
I like zero.
Zero, yeah, but in practice.
Anything I can drive to zero cycles makes me very happy. For what?
For just kernel exit and entry.
This is so dependent on the hardware and the generation of the hardware and the cleverness of your assembly path that there isn't a straightforward answer to it. It also depends a lot on your memory hierarchy.
But it's not low.
It's not low. Okay. It's a rule of thumb about 1,000 cycles to get in and out of the kernel.
Feature better.
Okay. I can go as high as 4,000 if you get unlucky. Also, but it also depends what mechanism you're using, right? So the syscall and sysenter mechanisms have very different overheads and interrupt trap mechanisms. It also depends on how much locking you have to do. It's much faster to do that on a uniprocessor than on a multiprocessor because there's more work to figure out where your stack went. Maybe you actually just put in the other day. Now, remember I said contention dynamically was rarely going to be observed to happen. In practice, you're not going to see people bottlenecking on these processes because you're not going to see more than one read request at a time. A terminal request. even when you fork off those background processes, it is not often the case that they actually write at the same time. We'll take a break. Oh, boy. I apologize. We were much later in the first chunk than I normally do, and I apologize for not taking a break sooner. I lost track. We'll do that in just a second. I want to show you this, and we'll come back to it. Actually, you know what? No. Let's take the break. Pause and think about this and ask yourself if this will get the problem under control, and then let's figure out how to optimize it when we come back. But let's take 10 minutes.
I apologize. Please don't hesitate to interrupt me and remind me if I lose track of time. It's okay.